You know, they tell the story of the prasadam and all the things that were done to keep the prasadam safe. And of course, Radhanath Maharaj was the night guard, and he could guard everything, but he could not guard the Mahaprasadam from the senior Vaishnavas if they were in such a mood as to raid the cabinet. And I remember one night, and I can't remember, Maharaj might be able to chime in and clear up my memory a little bit, but I remember in the winters, Maharaj would sit inside here in this prasadam room, and also this devotee Taru, the prasadam addict, would sit and eat, chant with Maharaj. And I remember one night, it being late at night, I forget what happened, and if we were cooking for a festival, but Maharaj was in there. The prasadam room out here eating, and Mother Vishvadika, who was pregnant at the time, coming across the prasadam room crying behind Taru's wife, Mahara, who had the bag of his 40 chapatis, because he couldn't eat around us, because everyone would get envious. So she's walking through the prasadam room with his 40 chapatis in a brown bag, and Mother Vishvadika is walking behind her going, crying because she's pregnant and she's not getting enough chapatis. And she's going, she's crying, she's going, "This is crazy!" And I'm just watching, "This is crazy! I should get more chapatis!" One time I was, there were all these rituals you went through to get prasadam in New Vrindavan. And one was if you were fortunate enough to be Kirtananda Maharaj's servant, where you could bring him his lunch in his cabin up here, he would eat very, very austerely, eat very simply, but you would bring him his tray, and he would sit humbly in the corner while he ate, and then he would serve the other Vaishnavs, and you would sit there humbly and, you know, give them little pieces off his plate. And the whole time, of course, you're looking at the plate and you're thinking, boy, I hope nobody wants that. No. I want those milk sweets, you know. So you're just praying that there's not too many guests in the room. And after they take the prasadam, then you take it and humbly walk out the door as if you were going to clean the plate. And there were windows. If you look up at the cabin, there are windows. So you had to plan it so that as you were going out the door, closing the door behind you, you were grabbing the first sweet ball, or whatever it was, and sticking it in your mouth. So when you went past the first window, nobody saw you had it, and then you kind of chewed it real quick, and as you turned for the second window, as you went down the next step, you threw that sweet ball in your mouth. And then you'd come to the end of the walk past that window so no one saw you, and then you'd hesitate at the last, as you came off the porch, you'd hesitate right there between the last step and his shower, and he'd stop and throw as much in your mouth as you possibly could before turning onto the steps where the rest of the devotees could see you. So you'd have to try and eat at least six things off the plate before you were able to get them their plate. On this one particular day, I made that turn and started coming down the stairs with Kirtananda Maharaj's plate, and I looked off to the left to where the incense warehouse was, but where Kaladri and Katila were now living. And inside, we had no, you know, there was just a wooden slat door, and in the summer, just a blanket would hang over the door. So you could leave it open and get a little air, but a blanket so people couldn't look in. And as I was going down the steps, I just glanced into Kaladri's room, and the curtain kind of blew a little bit, and I saw a face just sitting there looking out of the crack, and I had the tray, and I'm, "Who is that?" You know? So I walk over to Kaladri's room, and it was like the day of a festival or the day after a festival, and I'm holding the tray, and I hold back the curtain, and sitting on the floor in Kaladri's room against the wall is Taru. And he has on his lap, the prasadam addict, he has on his lap a tray with 200 laddus. And he's just sitting there looking up at me. And I'm holding the tray, and he goes... So I take a look down the staircase. I go in, sit down, not a word is spoken until we do about 25 lobbies. So I read the prasadam addict. Just trying to read some of those stories. I'm going to have to be leaving, but I'd just like to say, all these stories and hearing the seriousness of the devotees, I mean, of Maharaj talking about when the demons came and... You know, the austerities that the devotees lived through here in those early days was literally like a war when you lose 40, 50 pounds in 6 months. And, probably within 100 feet of where we're sitting right now, three children died in the early days. I mean, there were devotees that did give their lives building this place and suffer greatly. For myself personally, this space right here is very, very, very important. This temple, if some of you go up later and look at the cabins up on the hill, where the devotees actually live. Don't too many people go into the building at one time because it may roll down the hill. But to go in and see how austerely the devotees lived in those first few years, you should see it. And this little patch from here to the kitchen below, this building, Kirtananda Maharaj's cabin, and those two cabins up on the hill are really the last thing that's left of those very early days in New Vrindavan. So it would be nice if somehow or other we could come up with a plan to try and preserve them and make a nice little memorial here too, so that when people come, an old fat person like myself could sit here during the day and tell people about what it was like to be in New Vrindavan in those days. So if anybody does come up with any kind of plan, I'd be happy to talk to them and perhaps help out. And thank you all. It's been nice talking to you. It's great to see everyone in here. I'm amazed because, as the devotee said, the wall right there, that railing, was the back of the temple. And to think how many devotees would get in this one temple room for those festivals. 200-300 devotees would be crammed in this room. Srila Prabhupada, when he was here, sitting just further up, right where you're sitting, the Vyasa-san was there. Prabhupada sitting there looking at Vrindavan Chandra. So, thanks. It's been nice talking to you all. Hare Bol.
His Gayatri. Well, Gargarishi was famous for falling asleep. So Gargarishi went, sat across the room, and immediately fell asleep. Well, he woke up and thought that he was late. He had slept through the lunch. So he immediately hopped up and grabbed the tray. He didn't notice that Kirtananda Swami was still doing his Gayatri. So he took the tray and headed out the door. And as Adwaita pointed out, when you get the first door, you had to get the first sweet in your mouth. So he's walking out the cabin, and he's got... And Gargarishi had perfected this technique. He was one of the best. So he had about a third of the plate eaten by the end of the... By the end of the walkway around the cabin. By the time he hit the end of the walkway, Kirtananda Swami had finished his Gayatri and had screamed out to Gargarishi, who had no idea that he'd eaten the prasadam before Kirtananda had a chance. Kapha Punj Prabhu.
Thank you. I don't think we've done enough justice to describing the area in which the prasadam was cooked.
Oh,
and that is the area famously known as the pits. When we leave this building and you walk out, you'll see, I think Radha Swami will reply to you, or Chandramali Maharaj also was a cook in the pits. You'll see this area next to the small black building below us here. And at that time, that black building served a dual function. The first function was that it provided an enclosed shelter for cooking for the deities. And actually, if you go inside that building right now, as bad as it looks on the outside, on the inside, it's actually a nice marble floor, marble countertops. And upon entering in those days, it would be filled with 5 to 10 of the mothers in the community who would be cooking all the wonderful preparations that Kalaji Prabhu was describing. So that was the first function. It served as a deity kitchen. And it was very wonderful living in this community to see. And we talk about the deities are the center of the community, you should give everything to Krishna. But actually, when you live in a village-like setting, in which the deities are so close, and the cows are so close, and you actually see the way in which the devotees are actively serving the deities and the cows, you're convinced of that philosophy, actually, that Krishna is at the center. So that small black building, in serving that purpose as the deity kitchen, not only were wonderful preparations coming out of that, saturated with devotion, but also the timing, the exact timing of everything so that that one principle of deity worship, punctuality, is being very, very closely and strictly observed. So it's, you would see a hustle and a bustle about getting everything done on time. And then the pujari, or sometimes the cook, would come, you know, running up the steps at 11:43, because it had to be, if I remember correctly, it had to be on the altar at 11:45 to make the offering, to make the 12 o'clock offering. So that was a wonderful experience to see how, and we come from such impersonal backgrounds that upon seeing, learning about the arch of Vigraha form of the Lord, it's all kind of theoretical at first. In fact, when I first came here in 1974, I had never seen deities before. And I think the second day I was here, there was a Sanan Yatra for Lord Jagannath, the big Jagannath deities. And is that, that I'm saying that's the festival when she's bathed with yogurt. And I was a bhakta, had never seen the Jagannath deities before. I was living with the brahmacharis in Old Vrindavan, and I came down second or third day I was here. And there was Jagannath, and there was Balaram and Subhadra, and they each had, they were placed in these farm-like metal tubs. And elaborate arrangements had been made to bathe them with yogurt. And at that time, the community, I think, was 40 or 50 people. And everyone was lined up in queue. And one pujari was standing, handing a conch shell full of yogurt. So I was a bhakta, and I was trying to understand, what is this going on? So I asked one of the devotees, I said, who is that, those three persons in the tubs there? And they said, well, that's God, and that's his older brother, and that's his sister. So I was trying to kind of digest that, and I said, well, what are they putting on his head? And they said, well, they're pouring yogurt on God's head. So I was trying to digest that. And actually, to be,
you know what's coming.
To be, you know, to show a mood of cooperation and submissiveness, I also lined up and I was pouring yogurt on God's head also. So the next day, after the festival, I came back down, and as the tradition goes in that festival, the deities are then removed, and they go for the recuperation upon catching what appears to ordinary eyes transcendental sickness or illness. So I was in the temple room here, and I asked that same devotee, I said, remember, you're telling me about God and his older brother and his sister, and they're getting yogurt on their head. Well, I don't see them today. What? Where are they? He said, they caught cold. So I was very much amazed that here I'm becoming attracted, enchanted by this movement in which you can actually pour yogurt on God's head. God catches cold, he goes away for a while. So I was very, having lived as a hippie for many, many years, I thought, these are really far out people. Because they even have a philosophy behind the whole thing. So that building that we call, that you'll see outside here in front of the temple, that block building served that function. It served in Radha Vrindava Chandi. But the other function that it served, that as I, Maharaj, when you were gone, I said we haven't done justice to describing the pits, was that it also provided the setting for cooking for the devotees daily. The daily cooking of all that austere prasadam that you've been hearing about was done not inside a building, but actually in an overhang outside the building, which is nothing but a few pieces of corrugated metal stretched on poles, suspended on poles above these cookers, which are nothing but 55-gallon drums with holes cut in and then grating, kind of crude grating put on top of them. And everything that was cooked for the devotees 12 months out of the year came from that place, including the majority of the Sunday feast cooking, if I remember correctly. So, if you've ever experienced a West Virginia winter in the 1970s, it was brutal here. It was very, very cold. There were, you know, record cold snaps where you go through 10, 15, 20 days in a row of below 10 degrees or just hovering at 10 degrees Fahrenheit. Yet, without fail, the Bridger Bossies here would perform their service every day. They would never give up their duty. They would always be there cooking. But the, as austere as it was, the absurdity of that, the ridiculousness of trying to cook under those conditions also served to kind of bond people into a sense of community. Sometimes we complain about little services that we have to do because they're hard on our mind or they're hard on our body. But when you actually see and witness somebody doing something that's very difficult, then, and you see that they're steady in doing that, that they don't falter just because it is difficult for the mind and the body, then you become more faithful. You see how the process of Krishna consciousness is transcendental to the vagaries of the mind or the vagaries and difficulties of the body. So more than any place I can think of in this community, those cooking pits seem to bring out in people the bhakti that's natural to all of us. And because try to imagine you're cooking and it's about 10 or 20 degrees out. Wood was provided, but often the pots weren't there in a clean condition. So you'd have to scuttle into the bathhouse below here and clean your own pot and bring it back up. And then you'd have to get water. There was no running water in those pits. So you'd have to find water, usually in the bathhouse, if I remember correctly, and bring your own water. And fortunate for me, but unfortunate, I guess, for the devotees, I had the distinction of being the lunch prasadam cook for a very short career. And the reason I became a lunch prasadam cook was because I was being the gardener across the street and behind the temple, and having kind of my hippie ideas about how things should be cooked, I was always complaining to the temple president, who was alive at the time. And one thing I found out very quickly about New Vrindavan was that the more you complain about something and, you know, point out the inconsistencies in the way certain things are done, the more likely it is that you'll be put in charge of it. So, at that point, I didn't understand how that worked here exactly. And
you still don't understand.
I still don't understand. So, I considered that I was performing massive austerities trying to grow these vegetables under very difficult conditions across the road there. I had no vehicles or tractors or anything. I was carrying, lugging up vegetables all the way up here. And the devotees would cook those vegetables into some kind of an indistinguishable mush, like sabji thing, that you couldn't really tell without some sort of, you know, genetic testing what is the original thing that you were cooking, you know, that you started with, what the voga actually was to begin with. And I was complaining and complaining. And finally, by the arrangement of Kirtananda Maharaj, I think mostly Kaladri, which he probably won't admit to, but I was put in charge of those pits. And my service was to cook the sabji, the rice, and the dal every day. And I found the biggest problem in doing that was that it took so long to heat the water for the dal that, you know, I just barely made the offering every day. Not only did you have to heat the water, then you had to cook the beans down. Another service that I rendered at the time was I had to grind all the flour for those chapatis that were coming. So it seemed to me that why should you have to cook these mung beans down, wait till they break down to make dal? Why not put them through the flour mill, make mung flour, heat the water, and just throw it in? Instant mung dal. quite simple. And it even colored the water, actually. It made it kind of greenish, you know. I thought, it works, you know. Sean said, now it's done. Everybody will be happy. Well, it doesn't work, actually. So I didn't last a long time as a cook in those pits. But I do remember seeing the austerities of... I'm going to pass this around because I wasn't in there a long time, but I do remember the experience as the cook of freezing behind me. The backside of me was absolutely frozen because you had to wear a dhoti. And there wasn't, you didn't wear your work clothes. You were in those pits as Brahminically as you could be. And I was wearing a dhoti. I was freezing on one side, and the front of you, because you were cooking on an open fire, was burning. So the hair on your shins was gone, and you're always moving your dhoti back to try to keep it from catching on fire. And the other thing was that the diet was a little hard on health, even when you're young. So the tendency was that you're always congested from that kind of very thick diet that we had. There weren't a lot of fresh vegetables and greens and things, and therefore your nose was always running. So there was this battle between freezing one side, burning up on the other, your nose was running and you couldn't see, so you'd be kind of stirring like this, sort of hoping for the best and doing it by memory from the day before. And then the most austere part was not that. That was difficult for the body. But the most austere part, and this was actually the measure of a real cook, who was a Krishna conscious cook, and that is that after you had cooked those preparations, did you have the courage to go up into the prasada room and eat with the devotees who were eating the prasada? Could you tolerate the comments that they were making about the prasada that you were cooking? So because I wasn't, and still I'm not very advanced in Krishna consciousness, I didn't last long as a cook.
It's just because you're a lousy cook. It has nothing to do with your Krishna consciousness.
But not only did the pit serve that function for cooking the lunch prasad for the devotees, but also all the milk that came from that barn that's no longer there. You can see the remnants of that barn, just the foundation is there. All the milk came over, and we had such profuse amounts of milk that the only thing that could be done with it was to make curd. And of course the natural byproduct of curd is whey. So this is probably going to be a little embarrassing for him, but I'm going to pass this on, because I didn't directly witness this. I'm hoping one of the other older devotees had been, but Chandramali Swami, we need to tell the pastime of the time that Chandramali Swami was cooking whey, or it might have been ghee, in the pits. Okay.
What do you want to tell?
No.
Can you?
I'm sure you can do great. I wasn't directly involved in that one.
Well, I was going to tell the story about the Bhokta story, which is very similar. Then Maharaj, you can tell us. You were there.
Yeah,
we had what were called pickle barrels. There were these big, tall barrels that we used to get in Pittsburgh that they would import pickles in. And after they would get rid of them, we could buy them for 50 cents a piece. And we stored everything in the pickle barrels. So there was a big barrel of whey. From, as Tava Point said, from making curd on a... There's one other thing you can make after you skim the milk, besides curd, is chaw. I forgot about the chaw. That's a whole other pastime I'll talk about later. But anyway, so there was always one or two big barrels of whey there to turn the next batch of curd. Well, there's a devotee, Bhokta, who used to do a lot of the cooking in the pits. One thing about the pits was, as he said, it's like an open fire. It's almost like cooking in a... there was a big opening in the front to put the wood in, and it's just a round barrel with fire, big round barrel with fire coming out. So the tips of your boots would often melt because your toes were right against the fire. Like you said, your back would be freezing, but the tips of your boots often caught on fire. And sometimes, as Adoita pointed out, if you had a polyester dhoti, if you lean forward, your dhoti would catch fire on the end of the fire. So at one time, Bhokta was cooking, was in the middle, he had three pots going, we had three different burners at least, sometimes four. So he's running back and forth, and all of a sudden his dhoti caught on fire. And he tries to put it out, but he can't put it out. So what he had to do was, he jumped in one of the buckets of whey, in one of the barrels, to put his dhoti out, because his whole flame was catching around him. So he had to jump inside the barrel of whey to put the fire out of his dhoti. And of course we had to cover him up because of exact same thing happened to me. Same story.
Happened to a number of people.
The thing was, it was windy out there. So when you get close to the fire, sometimes the wind would shift and blow it right up close to your dhoti. So when I was on fire, I was thinking, you don't think what to do, you just look for something to put it out. So the barrels away were there. Actually, Advaita was so fired up by that story that he actually wrote an article for the Brijabasi Spirit that I jumped in the barrel of white.
Kept it from getting burnt, too.
Yeah.
It worked.
But we had to get rid of the barrel of white, though. I don't want to tell this before prasad, but I'll do it anyway. New Vrindavan in those days was just the deities, the cows, and the devotees. Nothing else existed. The milk that came from the cows, except what was offered to the deities, everything was made into skim milk. The reason was that they wanted ghee for the deities. And the way that it's done here is they take the cream of the milk and then the rest is skim, and then they make the cream into butter and then they boil the butter into ghee. So in those early days, there wasn't that much milk. And they would put the ghees in jars about this big. And it was being used for the deities. And there was only like, what, 1 quart of ghee allotted for the Sunday feast program, for the feast for the devotees. So that quart of ghee was so precious, because all the devotees in the community, their feast prasad would be from that ghee. So at that time, the kitchen was right on the other side of this wall. It's just a small kitchen, and there was a wok on the stove, and they left the ghee in the wok. Sunday, that was Saturday night. Sunday morning, I remember, I came into the pujari room, happened to come into the kitchen, and there was a major conference going on. There was a rat, big, hairy rat, that entered into the wok and drowned in the ghee. So there was just this dead rat, and its hair soaked up most of the ghee. And that was the only ghee for the whole week for the Sunday feast program for the devotees. There was a conference of what are we going to do? Because all the devotees who were deciding, they were going to take the feast too. On one hand, they saw this is totally contaminated. And on the other hand, they were thinking, it's the only ghee there is. So ultimately, on the leader's instruction, one of the devotees picked up the rat from its tail, held it over the wok, and with his fingers went like this. Squeezed out every drop from that rat.
and then squeezing it hard and pulling it down. So all the ghee went back into the lock. Then they threw the rat out the window. And said, ghee is always pure, it cannot be contaminated. And whoever, I just was just a simple devotee, to walk in. And everybody who happened to see that pastime was made to promise that they would not tell anybody what they saw. Anyways, I remember the feast was served out, and I was just remembering that pastime, and the prasad was next to me, in front of me, and I was wondering, should I eat this? But I remember the story of Prahlad Maharaj. It's offered to Krishna, it's really nice.
I was in India at that time, by the way. So I think that it's time we should take a little prasadam. Marge asked me just to give you a brief explanation. At one point we had many cows, they were giving lots of milk. This was of course later on. And we had begun the business, and Prabhupada recommended that we sell New Vrindavan sweets and New Vrindavan ghee around to other centers. So we were starting to do that. So again, the process was you take the milk, which was very rich, you let the creams, and then of course they had what's called cream separators, little machine, hand cranked or electric, that would separate the milk and the cream, and then of course the cream would be turned to butter and then to ghee. So every drop of cream you had to get, because we were starting, was one of our little businesses to support ourselves. And so what was left over were actually gallons, huge amounts of milk, but it had absolutely no cream. It was the skim milk. It was just like white water. It had very little taste to it. So it really had no function. So Kirtananda had to figure out a way what we could do with this skim milk. So we developed a product that very few people knew about. It was called New Vrindavan Lockjaw Chaw. What it was, lockjaw was more descriptive than part of the title, because if you ate it, sometimes your teeth would stick together. Because it would lock your jaw. So we had skim milk that had virtually no taste, and we would just put tons of sugar in it and just cook it and cook it like you cook burfi, but cook it further like you would cook a caramel. And so all you had was skim milk and sugar. And then of course later we had some subtle flavorings that we would add, and we tried to market the lockjaw chaw. You know, devotees coming, you know, if you lived in a normal temple, prasadam was so tasty and luscious, then they would come to New Vrindavan and we would advertise this chaw. But it was, the only people that ended up eating it were the devotees at New Vrindavan. No one else could handle it. We tried to ship it out to temples and put it in fancy boxes and wrap it. New Vrindavan, nook sweets. But we didn't use that term because we didn't want to get, you know, we didn't want to get sued. And of course, Taru, who was a prasadam addict, always had at least three or four slabs of chaw in his back pocket. He would always be chewing on New Vrindavan lockjaw chaw. And if anyone was having, you know, going through their, they were just so hungry and there was nothing to eat, you could always go to Taru and get a slab of loaf.
I'd like to clarify something about oat water. Because I happened to be in Kirtananda Maharaj's cabin when the discussion first arose as to creating a breakfast preparation that would enhance and amplify the work ethic of New Vrindavan, which at that time, coming to New Vrindavan from city temples, of course, meant hard work, because those in-city temples who could not seem to make it as book distributors or preachers or the various services in city temples would be put on a bus with a one-way ticket to Wheeling, West Virginia, and we would pick them up and they would become part of the New Vrindavan scene.
Or if they were crazy.
Or if they were absolutely nuts. That was so I was in that cabin. That cabin, just above the hill here, was actually kind of the epicenter of everything. All decision-making and board meetings and everything came out, including the building of Prabhupada's palace. It was all kind of coming out of there, the meetings that we had. And apparently one devotee, I think it was Madhava Ghosh, had read an article where in a, I think it was a federal correctional facility, or it might have been a state prison, they had done an experiment on inmates. And half the inmate population was fed oatmeal, which we kind of traditionally think of as being very thick, stick-to-the-ribs kind of heavy breakfast cereal. And the other half of the inmate population was fed oat water. And it was determined after about 6 months of seeing the performance of these two groups that those inmates who were being fed oat water were more productive, that they were actually doing more. And when Kirtananda Maharaj heard that, he was immediately convinced that we should all be eating oat water. And the early oat water, although later, I don't know if Sankirtan is here, I don't think he is, but he was for many years the oat water cook. And because of the various amendments that he made to the original oat water recipe, it became rather an opulent prep, became quite nice. But the early oat water was oat water. there weren't many oats in it. It was mostly it was very, very, very thin. And I had the great opportunity at the time to be working hand in hand with Barsan Swami. We were brahmacharis at the time, and had a very austere schedule of rising early, chanting all of our rounds, and then we would be actually outside with the horses or mules, or later the bulldozers, at 6:37 in the morning. And therefore, we always missed what little mahaprasadam was served out. So we would be relegated to eating only the oat water and a little bit of white rice. And I just recall how going through that experience of not actually having your senses fully satisfied from a material point of view led to a lot of advancement to Krishna consciousness. And it seemed that that kind of typified the New Vrindavan mood, which made everybody so strong and feel very much bonded together, in that we were performing a lot of austerities. And because of those austerities, and focusing on keeping Radha Vrindavan Chandra in the center, so much was accomplished. So many things were wonderful going on, to the point where Prabhupada's palace was built and the community actually mushroomed to over 700 devotees were here, men, women, and children. So somehow we have to recreate, even though the conditions are not exactly what they were then, worldwide or even locally, somehow we have to recreate that opportunity to fulfill Prabhupada's vision for this community. And how it will happen, I'm not sure, but it will happen because it's Prabhupada's desire.
Srila Prabhupada ki jai.
This temple room really is a very sacred place in the history of New Vrindavan. Srila Prabhupada came to New Vrindavan in 1969. Then he lived in Vrindavan Farm. He came in 72, 74, and 76. And all those visits, this was the temple room. Each and every morning, Srila Prabhupada would give his Srimad Bhagavatam class in here. He gave dozens and dozens of classes here. I remember in 1976, sitting right there, and this little temple room, just half the size of what it is now, was just crowded with devotees from all over the world. Srila Prabhupada was speaking on the teachings of Prahlad Maharaj. The first class was a long class, but he saw everyone was sleeping. So he started giving very short classes, seeing the New Vrindavan devotees. They worked so hard, little sleep. Also, this was the place where hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of devotees were initiated by Srila Prabhupada. And I traveled in various places of the world, very often. I meet God brothers who tell me I was initiated at New Vrindavan. In fact, I took first initiation, second initiation, and sannyas initiation right here in this room. This temple room was the heart and the center of the community because it was the place of Radha Vrindavan Chandra, who we were aspiring to give our lives and souls to serve. Pahulaban is full of wonderful places. This photo on the altar of Srila Prabhupada sitting on this red Vyasasana, it's one of the most famous photos. Just a couple weeks ago, I was at Bhargava Prabhu, who was one of the chief photographers of Srila Prabhupada. And he told me he considered this the best photo of Srila Prabhupada. This photo, which all of you have seen probably hundreds of times, was taken right out in front of the Bhagavad temple. We'll show you the tree. Everyone, before you leave, please look at this photo. In 1972, when Srila Prabhupada came, we built this red velvet Vyasasan for him and put it under the tree outside of the temple. And he drove up and the devotees sat him down there. He was so happy. There was tulsi plants on both sides of him. Devotees crowded around. Here was Prabhupada. Everything around was just an utter muddy mess. It's the summer of 72. A broken down little farmhouse. And he was sitting on his Vyasasan. Devotees washed his feet. There was a guru puja for him. And then he spoke. He gave his welcoming address sitting there. So very pleased. Because Srila Prabhupada had spiritual vision of a very divine nature. Although to an ordinary person, even devotees who came from other places, they couldn't understand what is the purpose of this New Vrindavan. Just a few people living in mud, in old broken down poverty type houses, milking some cows. What is the future? Remember? People would criticize. What does New Vrindavan have to do with ISKCON, people would say. But Srila Prabhupada would come and see that and smile because he saw the potential, he saw the hope. As Prabhupada was sitting under that little tree in front of Bahulaban Temple, he had the vision that with bhakti, the glories of Krishna could be spread from anywhere. Prabhupada was seeing that if the devotees just chant Hare Krishna sincerely and surrender their lives to the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, this God-forsaken mud hole in the hills of West Virginia will be transformed into Vrindavan Dham. That was Prabhupada's faith in the holy name of Krishna and the path of bhakti. And to me, and to many of the other devotees who were here in that time, Bahulapan represents that. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada.
Tell the story, what actually happened. This is the story of what Prabhupada did when he visited this spot.
So, I was married to Yusuf at the time. I came here in 1972, actually. And, we decided to live self-sufficiently, because that's what Srila Prabhupada wanted everyone to do. So we actually leased 10 acres of land from Kirtananda, like 5 acres here and 5 acres across the road, everything you could see around here. We had a lifetime lease on. And there was an old house here, and we took it apart, and there was a big barn across, an old barn that was falling down. That was where we had the cow. And so we would go to Mangal Arati every morning in the ox cart, go up the road, and that was kind of nice. And we didn't have electricity or running water or anything. And I had one child at the time, and so we grew everything and canned all the vegetables to live through the winter, and just kind of totally dependent on Krishna. And then Srila Prabhupada came in the summer of 74, and Yudhisthira went up to talk to Srila Prabhupada. He was staying at the house across from the palace.
Krishna. Krishna.